Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
In recent years, the term rites of passage has been in vogue in our schools. Instead of graduation, some schools now have what they call a rite of passage ceremony. The ceremonies themselves have changed little, except that, unlike when I was a child, and the only really big ceremony was high school graduation, there's a sort of graduation ceremony every year. What happens in schools at the end of the year is not what I'm talking about today. Such ceremonies are fine, but they do not constitute what I'm going to call authentic rites of passage. To understand what I mean, we, and this includes our students, will have to explore our ancestral tradition. Every culture I know of had some kind of rite of passage. Rites of passage take many forms and involve the passage from one type of being, one particular role in a community, to another. Birth, the cutting of the umbilical cord, is the prime example, impossible to purge due to its necessity, as much as we have tried to medicalize and desacralize it. Birth is a transformation not only for the birthed, but for the birther as well. We are transformed into parents in the process. The entrance into adulthood, however, once the most important rite of passage, is almost non-existent in the modern world. Even the ceremonies that do remain, like the bar mitzvah, are often more about getting gifts than becoming an adult. Formerly, these ceremonies were so significant because, in leading the child through puberty and into adulthood, they taught us how to become full-fledged human beings in a particular culture. They answered the question, who am I? Teaching an individual how she belongs. In the absence of authentic, healthy communities, our youth find belonging in bastardized rites of passage into cults of violence and dysfunction. Much has been said about the lack of role models in some of our communities and its effect on our young men. It is certainly true that our streets are filled with boys and men's bodies, but I would argue that even when men are present, they have little idea about how to facilitate a boy's entrance into manhood. Indeed, Wall Street is among the streets I refer to as filled with little boys, and surely most of those men had fathers around. We require not only men, but also deep and meaningful, authentic rites of passage for our boys to become men. There is a desire we all possess for darkness. In Western civilization, coming from a long tradition, we have shunned the darkness, avoided it as though it were not a part of us. Darkness, in our dualistic cosmology, has come to be equated with evil. In our avoidance of the darkness, we have shunned the depth and struggle that should be a part of any authentic rite of passage. Even birth, the mother of all rites of passage, has become sanitized with drugs. Our youth are yearning for depth. If we do not help them journey into the darkness where genuine creativity can begin, they will find it in their own destructive ways. Tomas Ramirez is the executive director of Semillas y Raices, Seeds and Roots, a nonprofit organization focused on cultural preservation, community healing, and youth development. He's also the president of Infinite Conversations, a privately owned provider of consulting and training services that engages in gang outreach and intervention, as well as in the training of high school administrators and staff, police officers, and juvenile court judges. He is a youth counselor, conflict transformation and reconciliation facilitator, as well as a cultural sensitivity trainer. To this end, Mr. Ramirez develops goal-oriented plans in conjunction with therapists, educators, parents, and youth, and instructs on conflict transformation, restorative practices, and healing processes. Mr. Ramirez's methodology emphasizes the utilization of indigenous, traditional, and contemporary community-building, mediation, and intervention models. In undertaking his work, Mr. Ramirez regularly develops programs to address youth's contemporary issues. Tomas regularly lectures on conflict transformation, cultural preservation, critical pedagogy and popular education, gang culture and gang mediation. He's a member of the Chichimeca Nation and is a member of various indigenous organizations in the Chicago area. He serves as a minister for the Native American Church of the Four Directions Lodge. Mr. Ramirez previously served as the Crime Prevention and Street Outreach Coordinator for the Evanston, Illinois Police Department and as a popular education facilitator, Universidad Popular. He is currently working at the North Lawndale Restorative Justice Court, the first of its kind in the nation, and DePaul University's Peace and Justice and Conflict Studies program. Tomas Ramirez, welcome to Reimagining.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to see you. I mean, to hear you is amazing to to reconnect with you. And I just hope everybody's okay, including the family. And it's a great honor to be here with you today.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much. So I wanted to start out, I wanted to talk more about the restorative work, the healing work, the ritual practices that you engage in. And I guess I thought maybe we could start by just discussing a little bit about your work in healing and restorative practices and your journey and how you got there. Like, how did you come to do this work?
Absolutely. So I hope that I don't break any hearts by making this statement, but I was never trained or certified in restorative justice. What I am is a direct result of my culture. Growing up as a young indigenous person, I learned all the processes that were available to me to build community, to heal in community, and to be accountable in community. At the same time, as I was growing old, I got nurtured by different elders from different nations, and that strengthened my already existing cultural foundations, my perceptions of the world, and my practices as I started working mainly with young people involved in alternative social clubs. At times people call those gangs. So it was very natural. It was nothing that I was planning to do. I mean, had I had the opportunity, I probably would have studied something similar to what now is peace studies. I was a pre-med student, very different, very radical change for me to what I'm in contrast to what I'm doing right now. But one of the ways to show you, I'll give you a couple examples. My parents would throw birthday parties for my brother and I. We were not a wealthy family, but we were able to throw birthday parties for my brother and I. And of course, all of a sudden, different kids will come around. A lot of what people of my level as poor kids would show up around, you know, to pick around the fence that we had. And my parents would let everybody come in to the birthday party. Why? Because it was a birthday, but it was mainly a party for young people. They understood that is the in the well-being of all of the children in the area, it was the well-being of the community and in the future. That's an example of those practices of inclusion. Being nice to everybody, even in high school, I realized that I was okay. I mean, going to the high school on the west side of Chicago, I was okay with all the different sets. This is Chicago in the 90s. There were a lot of different street affiliations, but everybody was cool with me. And I realized that later on, that's because I was respectful and I was really open with everybody. So that literally bailed me out a few times. And I figured out that people really care for me, regardless of me being involved in some things or not. So out of that, I mean, taking that way of being took me to do some coaching for football, for CPS, but also just mentoring youth and then going to gatherings. It was not different to what I was getting at home, what I was seeing around my relatives, which is that, hey, whatever we get, we share it with others. Or whatever hardship that you're going through, we face it together. And if you have something to share, and it's something that people may need, you just share. So embodying those teachings is what led me to do my work. Later on, I started doing street outreach, but I was having the understanding of how important culture was to connect with people and to create spaces that were going to contribute to the well-being of others.
Yeah, you know, and I should share that your work is really important to me personally, because you've come and done work with students who are in our programming at Wisdom Projects. And I've really seen how powerful it is and learned from you in that work. So say a little bit about how is it that you engage people and how do you see the importance of using, rather than just talking at someone, how do you bring people into your circle through the use of ritual and of cultural tradition? Say a little bit more about like why that's important to your work.
Cool. First, we always talk about, I'll make a couple of distinctions first.
Sure.
We always talk about meeting people where they at, and that's good in essence. If we do not know where they at, we don't understand the context, we're just going to look clueless. So out of that, there's always the honesty, you know, especially when I'm working with a new group of people or a different age group. By now, I can say that I'm I'm an old dude now, you know. Now it's weird. Something happened. I woke up and all of a sudden I went from being the shorty.
It happens to the best of us, my friend.
Exactly. So I'm still trying to process that. No, but I'm not going to be relevant. At times, even when I talk about things, they're like, hey, you're old, man. So I allow people to educate me, to contribute to my education. And I ask, they might laugh at me a little bit, but I do not know any young person that, if given the chance, they're not willing to contribute to the development of others. Like I say, they might laugh a little, but hey, so that's one part. And asking questions, just trying to figure things out, and also being very clear about your limitations. You know, like, hey, I'm not here to fulfill all your wildest dreams, or I'm not here to promise you things. I'm here to walk with you. And I always say something like this, especially when we are in not the best environments. It's like, hey, or when there could be issues around hierarchy or age. I'll say, I'll be honest. Probably I'm going to be really lame. However, I'm not going to be bogus. Big distinction when you're working with young people. I might make mistakes. I might raise my voice. I'm a so-called adult. So I perceive things with my adultism. But I'm going to stand here for your dignity and your humanity every time, even when you drive me nuts. That's not going to change. So that's one of the principles that I use whenever I engage with people. Now, there are specific things that modern society is not unique to the U.S., you know, the global north, as it's progressing, or as we enter this era of the Anthropocene, that there's this focus on the human as the center of the universe, you know, even to the point that it's like a geological era. And the reality is that a lot of people who are not included, there are a lot of people who are not seen, the people who are not acknowledged. So that's a society that goes through that, starts losing those acknowledgements, those events, those rites of passage that acknowledge the transition from people's lives to another, that where you find new identities. Like we were sharing, you know, like I opened my eyes and next thing you know, I had gray hair and my knees ache a little more. Mm-hmm. So to give you a context, in the 50s, where there's one big transition of the identity in the US, you have high school graduation being one of those events. You graduate from high school and you could go work. I mean, you could try to go to college. I mean, whatever, but you could go to work probably at a factory and make a dignified living. So that was a transition. That was a rite of passage, high school graduation. And you were able to provide, you know, that's where we have the creation of the icons of the house with the white picket fence, getting the car, raising the family. Of course, that reality is falling apart. Therefore, the high school graduation as a rite of passage, as a step into other areas of life, doesn't have quite the same weight. Some people choose the military, especially that's one of the things that you still see people coming out of the hood or the barrio, you know, they're like, hey, I'm going to join whatever armed force. And this is with the most respect for the people who serve. But people will say, you know, like, hey, this is a way for me to go to another stage. And you no longer were a civilian. You know, that's a transition in your identity.
Sure.
Of course, that has changed because, you know, those institutions that are supposed to base their existence in honor codes are faltering. Hey, we're going to extend your tour 3 more months, or we're not going to give you the stuff that you need, etc. So I'm just giving you those examples to see that those events and those institutions that will sustain those life transitions are losing their strength. We could even argue that undergrad graduation from college is losing part of that, because we have a lot of young people who have graduated from college. You know, we have the college diploma, but their identity is in crisis, or they feel that they have not been fully acknowledged, or that they're ready to start a new stage in life. So that's where all of this starts to take place. Now, I'll make another quick distinction. You have ritual and then you have ceremony.
Mm.
And ritual, some people are getting really stuck in this, but ritual is gonna bring a series of actions with a specific purpose, you know? It could have a really good purpose. However, a lot of people, they focus on these, just on the actions. And that's where it lays the difference. In ceremony, you do what you need to do in a given situation. And this is aimed to making those acknowledgements, those transitions. For example, you have a headache, you might take an aspirin, and that's your ritual. But you have a cold, you're not just going to take an aspirin. You might want to drink some tea or get a different kind of medication. The same thing, like all of a sudden, if you have an aching knee, you're not going to take the cold medication. But we will go follow the series of events over and over, which is what ritual has, we might not have a good result. The other thing is that a lot of times, because you use specific actions over and over, ritual can be standardized, just like in education, and it's not going to fit everybody, which is the ceremony part. The ceremony will have ritual components, but it's going to do what is needed for that specific event. One more thing about ritual. Ritual has a beautiful and powerful purpose, which is for people to develop discipline, which is what you need as you go into a new stage of life. You need to develop the habit to be in these new identities. Now, how does that look into the rites of passage? We need people, especially as we enter the different stages of life, we need to be acknowledged, we need to be recognized and given the roles and responsibilities that come through that new stage of life with full awareness of what we're getting into. And in some instances, this might require a new level of responsibility, different risk factors. Certainly, it expands your perspective of the world. If we don't have those, we're just wandering. We're just lost. It's hard for us to make meaning because this might bring the absence of the sociopolitical development of a person. Hey, how am I going to know my voice if I don't even know about how to be in silence? How am I going to treat others with dignity and respect if my elders have not told me that that's the way to go about things? So we're losing by not having these acknowledgments or these rites of passages, we're losing a lot of the knowledge on how to be human. So of course I look at a deep cultural perspective, but there are communities and it's their choice too. At times if people don't want to connect more into some of the original cultures, you know, like happens a lot in urban settings, you still need tools to identify, figure out who you are and to coexist with others, you know? And so we still need to have those rites of passage. And they are also a beautiful antidote to the narrative of power and control that has denied the value, the importance, I mean, the existence of other cultures that had been in the losing end of the narrative of power and control of this nation. Now, enslavement of people, indigenous genocide, concentration camps for Asian communities, all those not so nice things that we have as part of the development of this society that have dehumanized others.
The one thing I wanted to just emphasize that you were saying is, or a couple things actually, that I think is so powerful in your work is that you bring into each space a humility and a willingness to ask questions, especially engaging with a younger person who's often been told that they're maybe don't know anything and people talking down to them a lot, and your ability to ask questions and to invite people into the space in a way that says, what do you have to offer to each other? Because in healing work, our own healing is an exercise in also teaching others how to heal. So as we're healing, we're also benefiting the community as a whole. You mentioned how sometimes in ritual, people are sort of just, you know, tend to go through the motions, but your notion of ceremony and how you engage people where they are, we're meeting people where they are, we're engaging people, we're creating a space for healing in which we don't entirely know what's going to happen, right? We're inviting people to share themselves in a powerful way. And I think those things are really important in particularly engaging younger people as we've done at Wisdom Project, but also in any kind of space.
Absolutely. How many times the young people that we serve have given us huge gifts through telling us the stories of resiliency, of survival, of courage. So I always say the more that you work with people, the more that you're aware of how you use this tiny little, not even a catalyst. I mean, you're kind of a cheerleader. And we get this reward, this payment by being able to walk with people in their most powerful moments, regardless of the circumstances. You know, well, there's, I always tell people, like, people, who are we? You know, no matter how cute, how eloquent we might be, who are we to deserve people trusting us with the most vulnerable stages of their lives, to put their hearts in our hands, to put all of their fragility in our hands? That's what is truly sacred, you know? I mean, I don't care what tradition you come from, but that's the real treasure, you know? And that should really humble the guacamole out of you, you know? Like, who am I? And I'm just thinking about something that a really good friend of mine, his name is Steve Byer, why so hippie, would say, you know, like, we have the narrative about listening to people because they're important, you know? They're the politician, they're the leader, they're the person, the academic. They're the ones who know, they're the important people. When if we pay attention, people become relevant. People become magical. People are wonderful. People become important because we actually listen to them, create a space for them.
Yeah, it's an amazing way to think about what we are as human beings. I want to really emphasize this idea that when we enter into this ceremonial space with humility and with a spirit of both teaching and learning in each of us, we talked about the narrative of power and control, but it's a way to move beyond that narrative into a place where we can begin to think of ourselves as so much more powerful than the narrative that we've already been given, because we have the capacity to heal ourselves, to teach others, to really engage people, and to really expand our sense of who we are and how we relate to the world as a whole. And that's just an amazing way to kind of think about what it means to be a human being, so much more than just sort of what we can buy or sell.
Absolutely. You made me think of two examples. So two beautiful men that have the luxury. I'm just really lucky to know them. One of them is a Dakota elder from Red Wing, Minnesota. He was the cultural advisor for the people in that area. And, you know, especially when we're doing men work, masculinity work, he will share, you know, I mean, everybody's listening to Uncle. I mean, whoa, you listen to him. And he always leads like, hey, yeah, we're here, we're trying to do things. And I'm the most busted person in the planet. I used to be a drunk. I used to be a womanizer. I used to be really lost. And everybody's like, wow, you know? So it's like, he's living with his most fragile and vulnerable self, you know?
It's hard for men to do that, isn't it?
Exactly. And like, if Uncle comes from that and he's this amazing ceremonial leader and cultural practitioner and advisor, like, oh, there might be a place for me in this new reality that I'm trying to live into.
Yeah.
I have another really good friend. He's one of the best outreach workers that we have in the city. His name is Rudy Sosa. He'll always tell his struggle with, you know, I mean, you see him, they call him Monster, for Cookie Monster, I think. Mm-hmm. But you think, I mean, he's like, hey, like, you see Rudy and you kind of like, hey, if you have those gut reactions, like, whoa, I'm not going to fool around with this dude, you know, I'm just going to keep on walking. And Rudy mentors youth in the community. He talks about his substance abuse issues, you know. He talks about how he chose not to retaliate the second time that he got shot, you know, and how it was really hard for him. I mean, like, how much he is still a work in progress. And these are the OGs in the community. He's one of the OGs, and he's one of the people who mentors others, and he's still working with some of this stuff, you know, and it's not easy, and it's not like he didn't have an impact on him. I mean, he got shot, you know, I was like, okay, so maybe I'm not as bad, given that I still get angry. Maybe I might still spark a little thing over here. I might have some really loose ends, but if Rudy is still being really open about that, I guess I'm all right. And that is beautiful, because that's the part of the sociopolitical development of a human being, when you get to see that you're worth it, you know, you're worth of love, care, but that you also have a voice. No matter how busted you are, you're not the worst thing that you have done, but you have a voice, and out of that voice, you can have agency and influence. And if you have those things, you can really transform your environment. And then there's the part about becoming a dignified human being. And then we're talking about real strength.
Yeah, that's amazing. We're going to take a quick break, and I want to explore a little bit about how your own cultural traditions and indigenous traditions in general have informed your work and how we can all learn from them. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a minute.
Perfect.
Reimagining is a place for people who believe that the stories of the modern world no longer sustain us, bringing us to the brink of catastrophe, ecologically, economically, spiritually. Our troubles cannot be solved merely through technology or even politics. Rather, we need to reimagine what it means to be human. We seek new stories, new poetics, new ideas, and we put our ideas and stories into action. This work requires the wisdom of those at the margins and by those with the courage to imagine a new world.
Welcome back. I'm speaking with Tomas Ramirez, and we were just discussing through engaging people with these ceremonial practices, these healing practices, these community building practices, we can begin to sort of expand our sense of who we are, expand our sense of our own dignity, and through our woundedness, really, we can begin to, and in the sharing of that story, we can begin to transform our sense of the world. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you can change the narrative, which you described as the narrative of power and control, and shift that narrative from the narrative of power and control into something different, and what you see that being and how you've been informed by your own cultural indigenous traditions.
Absolutely. I was thinking about a couple different songs. I mean, I use a lot of hip hop pedagogy because that's one of the new indigenous practices. Or, I mean, it's not old. It's not new, it's old. Mm-hmm. But it has a new, a contemporary look.
Sure.
So I was thinking about songs, but there's also the role of the ceremonial clown, what some people call the being clowns for peace, which is to acknowledge that we have a lot of harm that has taken place, and we cannot match that with more force, with the same kind of even violence or harm that has been enacted onto the communities. And yet is this feistiness that we have about being rebels. So I was thinking about Bob Marley, you know, and the song like Big Tree, you know, you're a big tree.
Yeah,
A small axe.
Small axe, yeah.
Another way that I put it, you know, because it tells you where mine is at, you know, how do you eat the big pizza? Hey, one little slice at a time, you know, or a little square. I'm in the Midwest, so they have a tendency to cut it into little squares. That's how you do it. Because otherwise, I mean, we look at these big narratives that have been developed at times for hundreds of years in different parts of the world, and it could be really frustrating. So what the restorative practices are, first of all, I think that we should start there, is those, when we're looking about the series of actions, the ceremonies, they had to have the one goal, which is to be in right relationship, which is to connect, which it also is to be accountable. And we achieve them by addressing the different levels of conflict that we can be with. And it starts with the self, then it goes into the others, the institutions, environment, and then the metaphysical. All of this is also the foundation of traditional cultures that are, once again, in right relationship. It starts to sound a little redundant because it's a circular process. But at the same time, when you have all these sustainable, you have all of these levels in right relationship, you have a balanced community, you have a sustainable community, and then you have communities that develop cultures of peace, which is kind of, I would say, I was using the term the Anthropocene. You know, you realize that humanity is not the center of the universe, you know, or what we also code as human, which is not necessarily communities of color or any non-Western perspective of the world, because we have other cultures, other societies that emphasize that. So this restorative practice is going to be anything that makes you connect, to be in that right relationship. It could be something as simple as to say, hey, I am all right. Or like Biko said in South Africa, black is beautiful. How healing, how powerful for a black male to be able to say that about himself. Talk about a healing action. Talk about a restorative action. Talk about a transformational action. But then to be able to see that in others, you know, the acknowledgement. I always bring the movie Avatar You know, I hope they don't charge us anything for mentioning that, like ICU, which is the extension of other greetings, you know, that we have. I am you, you're another me, and I'm another you. Ubuntu, you know, in the well-being of the individual is the well-being of the community, because you are, we are. Or as Mr. Frank Wall, the Lakota rapper, will say, when you rise, we all rise. That transforms your relationship with others. Institutions, the same thing, you know. And then environment, is this sustainable for me to make a decent living? Or do I relate to that all three as a bunch of notebooks and toilet paper in, that have not been processed, or as a grandfather? Do I, the technology, hey, I want to be like one of these companies that they say that they bring good things to life, but they create missiles. Or can I create technology so we have to have crops that don't use as much water, or that can really maximize the production of food in a way that is going to not be detrimental to the environment and really alleviate some issues in some parts of the world? And then ultimately the part is the spiritual component, which is how I'm gonna connect with everything else. That will be the glue for all these other levels. But we need to start acknowledging that.
I mean, and if the relationship is primary, if the relationship is primary, not each individual, right? If we think of the relationship as being the most significant element not there that's involved, then the restorative work, the key is to restore that relationship. It's not about getting payback. It's not about fighting for what's mine. It's about restoring the right relationship. And then, and that's really the only way we can heal and move forward together, or move anywhere together.
Absolutely. Retribution doesn't work. You know, people say, hey, you can do the time, you can do the crime. But then that what happens first for the person that caused harm is that, hey, you detach yourself from your humanity to be able to survive. So you lose yourself in the process. And then the person who received the harm, you might have a whole legal process, you know, the criminal legal system might say, oh, you know, Huey has to do X amount of time in this institution. And then, oh, justice got served. But then the person who received the harm continues to have those emotional gaps that were the result of the harm. And if you notice, then we have two people, the people that caused harm and the person who received the harm, who do not have the human needs, their emotional needs, knowledge or taken care of, but you also have no real accountability. And remember, accountability is connection. That's another way to code relationship. And
it's different from blame too, isn't it? It's like a little bit of a different, it's a subtle difference, I think, from blaming someone and saying you're, to taking responsibility. It's a, the notion of responsibility feels more empowering than just blaming someone.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that we have the opportunity as a nation to shed some of the old skin about some of our old patterns towards criminalizing others. And we are using a lot of really amazing vocabulary. And there are some things that we're talking about that there was no way that even 10 years ago we're going to be part of the mainstream. But we also have out of that politicization, things such as cancel culture, that come from a narrative that has a little more of resolution, which is not necessarily saying that it's bad, but we could fall prisoners to that when we'll say, hey, this person caused harm, yes, but then it's not about just kicking them out, you know? It's then like, we have to remember that we all are not our worst action, but accountability is connection. What are we going to do then as progressive, conscious, woke people to give this opportunity to a person that caused harm to reconnect, because that's part of their needs that we have, because this person who caused harm doesn't stand alone. This person has relationships that bring also obligations. So it's never just sending Fred or Huey. I use those last names a lot. I mean, those names a lot when I'm sharing in my workshops. It's not about just sending them off, you know, casting them off, because then it could be really cannibalistic. Then we start doing that to each other. That doesn't mean that there are not specific cases where they might not be able to be brought to reintegrate to the community, but then we have to develop an opportunity for a repair of harm agreement. And then it's up to the person to address their shame, to address what's happening in them, to see if they really want to be in connection, translation, accountable to that community or to the person that caused harm.
Yeah. I think that word shame is a really important one, because I think it often, for many of us who have, we've all done things that we're ashamed of, probably, right? We've all made many mistakes. And I think when we can't get past the shame, it makes it very hard to take responsibility and to really face up to what's happened.
Absolutely. Shame freezes you. Mm. And you're bringing another part, that the rite of passage and all of the healing, restorative and transformational practices should bring, which is the full emotional expression of the human being. You need to be fully emotionally literate, and then we need to practice. You know, it doesn't just happen overnight. Get with demanding of people. I do a very specific exercise where people are sharing about who they are, and it's hard. But then I bring this up. Hey, at least in one school today, you know, this being Chicago, in CPS or in a family over dinner, there was a young person that was listening to something like this, coming from an adult or parent, mentor, maybe teacher, but it was something like this. Hey, what's wrong with you? Why can't you get things right? What are you always messing up? No, we demand that availability emotionally, but also for people to be able to verbalize things, feelings coming out of things such as shame, but we're not giving people the platform, you know, and we don't know it ourselves, you know, how many times when we have, hey, we forgot to take out the garbage, or we broke our significant other's favorite cup. It's like, ooh, dealing with emotions are hard, especially in a society that makes fun of them because they're really scared of them, that tries to go away from it, also gives them a feminine connotation, which then equals it as being weak. There's nothing weak about emotions, you know? And if we don't express them, we don't become well-versed around them, then we literally become sick, or we just operate in two or three. Therefore, we're denying ourselves a lot of areas of our humanity. No, I always bring up the doing a lot of work with men of color, you know, like talking about how much, I mean, like my own relationship with my dad, we went from not being having a relationship, you know, to the point that we have done a lot of work and we care each other so much that one day we almost gave each other a hug.
Listen, that would be progress for me too, my friend. So we'll, but we're almost out of time, but I wanted to speak to the issue of thinking about restorative practices. It's been sort of a trendy thing these days, right? Like a lot of people talking about it, you know, much more now than even 10, 15 years ago. You know, you mentioned you haven't done the formal training, but it's part of who you are and part of your own kind of cultural tradition and your own family work that you did. I'm curious about kind of your feelings about that and about the direction that it's going in, as far as like people, the ownership that people take of the training, and how you see we can honor the cultures out of which some of these practices really arose in the process.
Oof. Thank you for bringing that up. I mean, that has been a big issue. So I never got trained in restorative justice, but then of course I was exposed to great mentors who used that. Well, first of all, we had to acknowledge that it was not developed in the academic world. I mean, mm-hmm. We have some of the most famous people like John Paul Lederach or Kay Prannis, who are some of the most amazing practitioners that also have spots in academia, acknowledging the First Nations, you know, all these Native communities who have had this as part of their essential part of being. That is changing. But to this day, I mean, just like with standardized education, when things are seen fashionable or they can bring a profit, there's the need to try to package them and control them. So I'm personally really against process of certification. I have a few issues when even saying training. I mean, especially when we're working with young people, you know, in my case, mostly working with brown and black youth, I tell them like, hey, I'm not training you. I'm sharing with you, and I'm trying to give you back something that belongs to you, that was taken away from you and you don't even know. That's why it feels funny. But it's an essential part of you being the warrior for your community. Somebody that's able to carry the burden of others is a part of the process of you becoming whole. It's a time for you to really be a gangster for peace. And so that transforms their eyes. And the reality is that like say, how can you certify about some of the most essential parts of somebody else's culture? So that's also an invitation for people who buy into that, you know? Hey, no, we have to honor them. It's like the same thing, like, hey, I'm a Reiki master. I pay $500. Man, if you're really doing your practice, you're going to honor where those things come from, you know? And if anything, you're going to say, I'm a practitioner. I am somebody who's using these tools to support me in my work, in my journey, before anything else, before I'm able to contribute to others. So there's a humility component. But at the same time, we have to recognize that now that people, the narrative, you know, the mainstream sees that these practices work. Now all of a sudden you try to turn it into a product. Like, no, we need to really make sure that those cultures that have been historically looted are able to be recognized for their healing processes. And that's doing also our own work as practitioners. It should be available for everybody. One of the things that we do with Semillas y Raíces, when we're not in pandemic times, is that every month we offer free training, you know, or free education for anybody who's trying to do work in their communities, because the practices are for the healing, the health, the happiness, the accountability of communities. And we cannot put a price on those. And of course, we deal with issues of contemporary world, you know, we have expense, etc. But it's not the essence of who we are, because human dignity does not have a price. Human history does not have a price. The different richness that we have as humanity when it comes to cultures, that you cannot be bought. You don't have the strength to wipe it out. That's why a lot of us is still here. So we just need to recognize a lot of that.
Tomas Ramirez, thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for reimagining with me.
Thank you so much. It has been a great honor. Please, a big hug to the family.
Thank you.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.